that they have elder parents, and they said they're constantly pushing the buttons. The one said to me, the biggest mistake I ever made was buying my mother a new TV. She lives on Ocean Parkway. The daughter lives here in Manhattan Beach. She is constantly running back and forth with her mother and puts her finger right on a volume button and goes all the way up with the volume, and it's blasting away, and people are banging on the doors and all to turn the TV down. She can't. She has to turn it off. And she tried to explain to her mother, push the other button. But, once she gets her finger on it, she hasn't got the coordination. So people like that, you don't think they're going to be able to unscrew the F-connector and put this thing in there, Dick. It's not possible. So they're going to have somebody there, unless they have a relative, of course. But in many cases, they're going to get somebody in to install it. Now, are they going to get paid? Are they going to have to pay a service charge on this stick, or are they going to get it free of charge? Over.
KUZ. KUZ, very weak signal, but I think we're going to be able to pull you out. Hold on for a second. Mel, for a person who has that lack of dexterity and has that much trouble running just the remote control for a television set, their life is complicated enough that I'd like to believe there is a relative or a friend in the building that's helping them out from time to time. I'd like to believe that 90% of the people who are elderly watching their soap opera in the afternoon have somebody that once per week or 2 weeks is going to come visit them and hopefully is able to do the installation for them. I'd like to believe 90% of them have somebody who's going to help them for that installation. They don't have to do it themselves. And there's going to be a certain number that can't do it. And so where's the solution going to come from there is a good question. Mr. KUZ, give us the full call letters and your name and proceed with your question or comment, sir.
Thank you, sir. KB2KUZ, my name is Alex. Sorry about the weak signal. My comment is, and technology is always in flux, whether it costs my grandmother $10 or it costs her $25, I'm more concerned with the fact that it's costing all of us a considerable amount of money to produce these coupons, just so that certain folks are able to still receive all of the air television. Whether or not there's an installation fee for the new rubber interruptible. The fact that there is still supposed to be over-the-air service in any form is significant. And I don't think the $25 one time equates to congestion pricing where people are paying to get in there sitting every day. This is a one-shot deal. You buy your converter box, you still receive over-the-air television. That's a good thing.
Yeah, I think you live in Kew Gardens, Alex, and you're not very far from the repeater, so you must be using a handy talkie or it's a little bit noisy. But I got almost all the words. If I understand what you're saying correctly, that since it's a one-time charge of, let's say, the converter is $75 for the Volkswagen version, and $50 is supplied by a coupon, and you, if the congressman in Mel's area is not successful, where the 25 extra dollars is not being supplied by your local government, if the person has to supply the $25 because it's only a one-time charge, and then they get the television for the next 10 years, and they got more channels of television with a higher signal-to-noise ratio, if all goes well, a snow-free picture, and each one of the channels is giving them two or three programs, I think you're pretty safe. I think you're saying they're going to come out ahead, and the $25 does not strike you as oppressive. That's what I think you're saying, Alex. I'm going to pass it back to you, Alex. Maybe I misunderstood you. KB2KUZ, K2RIW on the TechNet. My name is Dick.
Thank you, Dick. Yes, that's exactly right. It is not oppressive. It is a one-time cost, and of course, a lot of people are going to find it difficult to pay even $10 or $25, but in the grand scheme of things, well worth it, and my concern is also that the taxpayers are picking up the price really of the coupon itself, because it's not a $10 or $25 charge, but it is a $50 or $75 charge that we're all absorbing. KB2KUZ.
Yeah, you're right that we're absorbing it. However, if you compare that to the number of dollars we're absorbing for the war in Baghdad, it's small. You're never going to see the difference. For all I know, it's $1 per year difference in your taxes, Alex. That's a guess on my part. I think that's quite small. Right now, I believe each man, woman, and child in the United States is paying something like $5 in order to support all of the operations of National Aeronautics and Space Administration. Maybe it's $3, but it's some very small number like that. And I think we're getting our money's worth. All I've got to do is look at two of those pictures coming out of the Hubble Space Telescope, and I'm convinced I've gotten my money's worth. And NASA's doing a hell of a lot more than that. You watch some of the PBS programs showing you what's going on there in space, and some of it's pretty exciting stuff. Okay, I know we're going to be revisiting digital television a number of times between now and February 9th and beyond. It's going to be a hot subject. A lot of cash is going to flow buying all this new hardware. We're going to get a lot more extra performance. I think it's a good thing. I'm convinced that if it wasn't for MPEG, it would never have taken place. I mean, when I first started calculating how many bits of information you can get out of a 6-megacycle wide channel with conventional transmission techniques before you start using 16 QAM or 64 QAM, quad amplitude modulation is what QAM stands for, when you get more bits per symbol of transmission, but it requires higher signal-to-noise ratio. Or you go to COFDM, which is the European technique, or the 8VSD, which is the American technique for transmitting digital television. And the arguments will go on for years as to who chose the best system. I know somebody, a buddy of mine who lives in the Dallas area, was part of the selection committee that did the study to find out was the COFDM, the European standard, or the 8VSD, the American standard, which was the easiest one to use that gave you the best bang for the dollar, where you could just change the modulator at your television broadcast center and you're back on the air with digital television, as opposed to redesigning everything from the antenna all the way down to the camera, so to speak. So each group is positive they've made the right choice. The Europeans have a lot of pride. They use a PAL system right now for analog television. PAL stands for Phase Alternate Line. We use NTSC, National Television Selection Committee, and there are people who are convinced that the European system is different just because they've got pride and they want to make sure that whatever the United States used, they use something different. And so when it comes to digital television, there are people who think the Europeans made a similar decision. I'm not sure it's quite that simple, but we do have different environments. We tend to live with a lot more multicast and a lot longer range between our broadcast center and the general consumer, whereas the Europeans have much more localized television transmission with a very different system, a little bit more like cell phone base stations with a whole lot of access points, so to speak. So, therefore, there's good reason to believe that their choice is better for them and our choice is better for us. We'll soon find out. I hope you're still there, Chris. I'm sorry we delayed you so long. KC2RGW, if we haven't put you to sleep, KC2RGW on the TechNet.
Put me at the end of the runway and two-wheel.
You're there, along with Bob. Go ahead, Dave.
Yeah, KC2RGW, Chris here. Hopefully the digital TV network here. Some of you might be amateur radio operators. Might be able to help me out with an antenna question. And I hope this is the easy one. I'm pondering putting up something like a Cushcraft 13C2 VHF beam, and it's going to wind up with one rotor under it. And I was wondering if there is an easy way to remotely flip the polarization of a beam from vertical to vertical from horizontal without having to climb up on my roof and do it. And that's pretty much it. KC2RGW back to the test.
Very fine, Chris. Sorry I gave you the wrong name there before. Yeah, there's definitely a way to do it. The Alliance R150, I think it is, rotator. That's the rotator where the mast goes through the center of the rotator. If you mount that rotator in the middle of the boom of the Yagi, that rotator will rotate polarization for you. I know of a number of people who have done that successfully. So putting one of these through the mast rotator type rotators in the middle of your boom of your Yagi is one approach. There have been other guys who have done slightly more Mickey Mouse techniques where they put a Pittman arm off to one side of the boom of the Yagi, and some kind of an actuator pushes and pulls on that in order to swing the Yagi from horizontal to vertical. Two telescoping pieces of tubing go in the center of the mast. One is in the center of the boom. One is the real boom down the center, and the outer piece of tubing is the one you clamp down on with the mast-to-boom clamp, and therefore you have the ability to rotate polarization. That's one approach. It's been done quite successfully. The other approach is to literally duplicate your Yagi. Because horizontally polarized elements and vertically polarized elements mounted on the very same boom do not see each other. There have been a number of guys who say, okay, I'm going to measure every one of the elements of my horizontally polarized Yagi. I'm going to build another element just like it, and I'm going to drill some holes in the boom 1 inch further forward, and I'm going to mount all of the vertical elements 1 inch further forward with a separate feed line. Now you either feed the horizontal feed line or the vertical feed line, and you've got that polarization electronically. If you choose the electronic approach, you have another hidden advantage. You can now, with the right kind of blending circuitry in the shack, you don't have to feed either the horizontal or the vertical. You can feed them in various combinations. If I feed each horizontal and vertical Yagi half the power, I will have slant 45 degree polarization. If I feed them in phase, I'll be slant 45 to the right. If I feed them out of phase, I'll be slant 45 to the left. If I feed them half the power, but 90 degrees of phase shift, by an extra 90-degree jumper cable to the horizontal or the vertical, I'm now transmitting clockwise or counterclockwise circular polarization. As you can see, if you choose the electronic approach, you have a hell of a lot more options. And so, depending on where the signal is coming from, what time of day, what's the state of the ionosphere, and so on, it can be a hell of a lot of fun to listen to the guy horizontally, vertically, slant 45 right, slant 45 left, clockwise, counterclockwise. And if you want to go one step further and you start adjusting the amplitude ratio between the horizontal and the vertical, as well as the phase shift, you can now transmit elliptical polarization with any elliptical ratio you want between the major axis and the minor axis, and any tilt angle you want of the major axis. You can literally do a polarimetry experiment, and you can tune the polarimetry to maximize the signal you're listening to today. If I had my choice, and if I had a little bit of elbow grease left over, so to speak, and a little bit of enthusiasm, I would choose the electronic approach as opposed to the purely mechanical approach. But both of them are a lot of fun. Once you start doing this whole process, Chris, you'll discover very rapidly that polarization is something that is mystified. It's a mystery subject to a hell of a lot of guys who are supposedly antenna savvy. Among the antenna engineering people with 10 or 20 years of experience in antenna engineering, when you enter the subject of circular polarization and its variations, you'd be amazed how many of them say, I don't really understand it. There's a lot of them. So as you slowly become expert in that area, you can have an awful lot of fun, and you can be educating a whole lot of people, Chris. KC2RGW, KQLIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, very good, thanks. Yeah, actually, by the time you look at the expense for a rotor, it'll probably be about the same expense to go ahead and just put another antenna up. And then, it's going to offer me a lot more versatility. Yeah, thanks for that suggestion, actually. I hadn't really crossed the numbers out and looked at that. Just looking at the cost for a single antenna, so it could be very useful. KC2RGW is actually nice.
And if you intend to do it by the second antenna, Chris, you've got a couple of choices there. You can literally measure the element length of your current Yagi and go to a hardware store and buy aluminum tubing of the same diameter and cut yourself a second set of elements and mount them on the same boom. That's approach number one. Approach number two, you say, hey, I want to write a check and I want the problem to go away. You literally go and buy a second Yagi and mount the second one vertical and the first one is horizontal, and the two booms can be literally mounted together side by side, held together with a hose clamp and maybe a little piece of wood in between to give it some stiffness in polarization. So you have the option of mounting the second boom parallel and touching the first boom with the elements of the first one horizontal and the elements of the second one vertical. And if you're a little bit lucky in the way the elements and the driven element work out, they won't interfere with each other. They won't touch each other. Two separate feed lines, and you got it all made. So even if you choose the electronic approach, you've got a couple of subsets on that choice. I wonder if that made some sense, Chris. Go ahead.
Yeah, it definitely did. Okay, so I'm feeding out of a radio with a single output on it. I have these two Yagis, one vertical, one horizontal. What would be the electronic gizmo to do the feeding, phasing, whatever it would be that you're talking about to vary the polarization?
Okay, that comes in many forms. The simple form would be a simple single-pole double-throw switch where single-pole double-throw, yes. The output of the transmitter goes into the switch, and you either feed the horizontal cable or the vertical cable. That's a simple approach. The next level of approach would be the output of the transmitter feeds a power divider, and now the power divider feeds half of the power horizontal and half the power vertical. That will give you slant 45. Then by way of relays, you flip in a separate piece of coax cable into the horizontal or vertical, which is a half wave long, and that will flip the horizontal or vertical to the opposite phase, 180 degrees out of phase, and therefore slant 45 right in polarization becomes slant 45 left. If you don't put in a half wavelength of cable, but you put in a quarter wavelength of cable of that jumper out of the power divider, so once again, out of the transmitter, into a power divider, the two power outputs of the power divider, one goes directly to, let's say, horizontal, one goes to vertical through a 45-degree length of extra cable, now you're transmitting circular polarization, and if that length of cable going to the second antenna is 90 degrees long, quarter wavelength long, you'll be clockwise, making it three-quarters of a wavelength long, 270 degrees, will make it counterclockwise. So I think you see, with various techniques, it could be a manual switch, or it could be with relays if you want to do it elaborately. But once you see the principle that any of the slant polarization or clockwise polarization do require a power divider. And by the way, that power divider at first doesn't have to be an expensive item. A simple T connector is a power divider. I'll admit it gives you a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio, but only the transmitter will see the 2-to-1 standing wave ratio. And if you readjust the tuning and loading control on the transmitter, or put a quarter wave matching transformer between the T connector and the transmitter won't even see the 2-to-1. A 2-to-1 VisWire, by the way, is half a dB of loss in the worst case. So until you decide to build or buy an elaborate power divider, a T connector will serve very nicely. I won one of the antenna contests once by feeding two antennas without a proper power divider, just by using a T connector. I took the half dB hit, but I still got a 2.5 dB advantage. I wonder if that all makes some sense, Chris. Here we go. KC2, RGW, K2RIW on the TechNet.
It certainly does. With the power of the internet, chasing your answers, sound telewave incorporated and power dividers, so eyeballing those while you're talking. I appreciate the information, and I'll turn it back to the group and move it along. We're running along a little bit behind schedule with the other guys in line. Thanks again, KC2RGW.
WB2HWW with a comment.
Howie recognized. Get to you in a second, Howie. Chris, you're on a very interesting project to make polarization diversity, I'm going to call it, polarization adaptability. As you build this, whether it be successful or unsuccessful, I'd be very beholden to you if you would come back in future weeks and tell us how it goes, how well it works. One of the very first Yagi antennas I built, way back in the dark ages of the late 1950s, early 1960s, was a six-element Yagi on 6 meters. Six elements vertically polarized, six elements horizontally polarized, with two separate feed lines. and during band openings I would flip back and forth between horizontal and vertical polarization to see which one sounded better after the signal had been through a sporadic E, and the answer sometimes was surprising. I wasn't smart enough in those days to know about circular polarization, so I never fed them simultaneously. But you're bringing back a lot of history for me, and so I'd like to hear about how your experiment worked, and please come back and let us know. Howie, go ahead with your question or comment. KQRAW and the Tech Man.
Dick, can't he just take a proper piece of length of cable at the end of that T and transform it back up to 50 ohms at his particular frequency? Couldn't he play with another piece of quarter wave matching cable at the T before he goes into his feed line?
Yes, he could, but it's a much easier way. When you use a output of a transmitter into the common port of a T-connector, and then take the two outputs of the T-connector into the antenna, the only thing that really sees the mismatch is the transmitter. So the transmitter is seeing a pair of antennas in parallel, 50 ohms each. The transmitter is seeing 25 ohms, and that is a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio. For most of our transmitters, that's a minor problem. But you're absolutely right. If you put a quarter wave of 37 ohm cable between the transmitter and the T connector, everybody's happy and it's matched in all directions at once. That's not completely true from the antenna point of view, but as long as the antenna has got a reasonable standing wave ratio, the power goes up the cable once, doesn't reflect back down, no real problem. So if the common port is the easiest place to put the quarter wave matching transformer that you're mentioning. You could put the quarter wave matching transformer in the output of the T connectors, but now life gets more complicated because there you're adjusting lengths of cable in order to go with the various kinds of slant polarization and circular polarization, and now simultaneously getting the right phase delay and the right impedance match on the output of the T connector, life's a bit more complicated. I would do it on the common port of the input to the T connector in between transmitter and T connector, and that is once you accept the fact of electronically tuning in polarization or angles, you can have an awful lot of fun with this whole system. One of Howie's suggestions is to run a inverted V, one of them east-west, and inverted V north-south. And he can feed them one at a time to favor a signal east and west or north and south. He can feed them in combinations to feed signals in the desirable directions that are intermediate between north-south and east-west, to 45-degree points. Also, when a signal on whatever band you're on has been reflected off of the ionosphere, particularly at HF frequencies, the signal will always be twisted in polarization. You may launch a horizontal signal from New York, and your buddy who receives it in London, after it's been through the ionosphere and twisted three times, he may receive it as a vertical signal. For this particular hour, of this particular day, of this particular state of the ionosphere, Faraday rotation is always taking place in the ionosphere. It's one of the things that is not well emphasized in any of the books we read. Therefore, any kind of an antenna that has polarization diversity, by that I mean a inverted V antenna that is north-south, and you're listening to a guy that's east-west, he's looking at the inverted V broadside, he will see pure polarization horizontal. A guy, when you've got an inverted V that is east-west, and you're talking to somebody to the east, he sees primarily vertical polarization. So you think you're aiming the angle of signal transmission when you go from the east-west inverted V to the north-south inverted V. You're also changing the polarization state. So now a smart guy who's got the ability to slowly slide the amplitude between only the east-west inverted V versus only the north-south inverted V versus various amplitude ratios between the two, versus various phase ratios between the two, he can have a grand old time with angle of arrival reception peaking up, as well as polarization state peaking up. With that kind of a simple antenna made out of wire and the right kind of a switching network in the shack, I guarantee a hell of a lot of what you think is a fade can become a non-fade when you tune the antenna correctly. You're getting into phased array techniques, you're getting into polarization adaptability techniques, and so it's a whole area that hasn't been well touched by ham radio operators, and it's about time it is. the hints that Mel has been getting for the last year and a half, where he's got this very simple, small fraction of a wavelength diameter loop antenna on 80 meters in the shack with him. And he's comparing the reception on that small loop antenna in the shack versus a full wavelength 40 feet in the air loop antenna of 270 feet of wire versus a full half-wave dipole. In the majority of cases, the simple loop antenna in the shack gives him better reception. At first, that sounds crazy. The reason he's getting better reception with the loop in the shack is it's adaptable. That small loop in the shack, he can rotate it in azimuth, he can tilt it in elevation, he can rotate it in polarization. So as he rotates, tilts, and polarization rotates, he can peak up that signal for that particular state of the ionosphere, and he's getting a significant number of decibels of improvement each time he does that. And because of the laws of reciprocity, as long as he is using high enough power variable capacitors and wire and whatever in that loop antenna, he can retransmit back through that. He's done very little of that so far, because I don't blame him. He's a little bit concerned about radio frequency biohazard. He doesn't want to put a whole lot of lop watts into a loop antenna that's only a few feet away from him in the shack with him. And there's various ways with rotating devices, he can mount that loop antenna on the roof of his house and transmit back through it. And when he does, he's about to discover something else. I'm making a prediction. He's going to discover that when he tunes the loop for best tilt, rotation, and azimuth for the best reception on receiving, he's going to find that an entirely different loop orientation is required for the best transmission to that same guy, whether it be in Pennsylvania or in London, because the Faraday rotation of the ionosphere does not obey reciprocity. When you transmit the signal from New York to London, maybe the signal twists clockwise 3.5 times when it goes from New York to London. When it comes back from London to New York, it is going through the same ionosphere, but because the magnetic field is at a different orientation on that particular path, direction, Faraday rotation gives you a different amount of rotation and maybe a different rate of rotation, and therefore the best polarization, the best setting of the antenna for transmit may not be the best antenna for reception. And with a couple of simple experiments, you'll find that out. And that would be a fun experiment. Now, I think this is some of what Howie is approaching. And you may have to go to the higher power mode, Howie. And I think this is some of what you're talking about. WB2HWW, if any of the comments. K2RAW in the TechNet.
Okay, Ted. All I'm going to say is that, yeah. Now, do they have 37.5-ohm cable? Is that available?
No, I don't think so. However, there's about two different ways you can make it, Howie. A pair of 70-ohm cables in parallel is 35 ohms, more than close enough. On HF frequencies, that's the easiest way. Take a pair of 75-ohm cables, put them in parallel, and that's 37.5. How about that? 75 ohm? I think RG11 is either 70 or 75, and it probably is a 75-ohm cable. Close enough. That's one approach. When it comes to VHF, UHF frequencies, to make a quarter-wave transformer out of square aluminum tubing, one-inch tubing, and buy the right diameter of brass round tubing out of your hobby shop and mount it down the center with the type N connectors on the end, making a quarter-wave matching transformer mechanically at VHF, UHF frequencies is fairly simple. On HF frequencies, the best ways of doing it with various kinds of cable combinations. Back to you, Howie.
Okay, but this is going to be a receive antenna. Do you really think I have to match it?
No, you're absolutely right. Transmitter-wise, it's a good idea to try to match the impedance, because most of our transmitters nowadays, because they don't have tuning and loading controls, because we want compact transmitters, some of them can barely tolerate 2-to-1 Biswas, some of them will only tolerate a 1.8 or a 1.75 before they start cutting back in power. So transmitting-wise, you're sort of compelled into doing a pretty good impedance match. A receiver is extremely forgiving, particularly an HF receiver. My guess is an HF receiver will give you the same signal-to-noise ratio. If the antenna is anywhere between a 1-to-1 and a 10-to-1, standing wave ratio, a 10 to 1 standing wave ratio antenna on an HF receiver on, say, 20 meters and down, 20 meters, 40 meters, 80 meters, 160 meters, a 10 to 1 VisWire antenna will give you a slightly different S-meter reading, but the exact same signal-to-noise ratio. On 10 meters, if the band is not open, I'll admit there's going to be some difference, because eventually it starts making, the high VisWire starts making a little bit of impact on the noise figure of the receiver system, and noise figure on 10 meters and above does start counting. But for 20 meters and 15 meters and down to lower frequencies, you can get away with a huge mismatch, and the receiver will never know the difference. What's really happening is the noise on the band is so high, and the signal is some medium amount above that, that when you have a highly mismatched antenna, yes, you get less signal, but you also get less noise, and the ratio stays the same. Your S meter will read a little bit lower, but what comes out of the loudspeaker will sound the same, all accommodated by your automatic gain control circuit. See, on 10 meters, the noise figure is starting to count if the band is not open. If you're only getting ground wave on 10 meters, the signal tends to be a little bit weak. The amount of noise of an antenna looking at the horizon on 10 meters is probably equivalent to a 6 dB noise figure. I think it gets down to a 4 dB noise figure on 6 meters. It gets down to a fraction of a dB noise figure on 2 meters, and there a low noise preamp really counts, and good impedance matching to get full performance out of the low noise amplifier does count on 2 meters and above. So if you're smart enough, a T-connector is a darn good power divider in many circumstances, particularly on HF antennas. On paper, it may look terrible as far as standing wave ratio is concerned, but with some very simple techniques, you can. It's a very good first experiment, and later on when you want to make sure you're doing everything just right, you buy or build a real power divider. And they're not that difficult to build or buy. So, I think we've gone down the list of people who had a yes when they signed in. Did I leave out anybody so far? If so, please now give me your call letters, KQRIW in the deck net. KQRIW in the
deck.
Oh boy, Joe. Yeah, you did give me a yes before. Wow, how did I skip you? Terrible about that. Go ahead, Joe. We'll spend as much time with you as you like. What would you like to talk about?
Also me, Dick, and Julio.
Don't worry, we got you and Bob. Go ahead, Joe.
Yes, I said yes or no. Okay, I have a question, I guess. In my neighborhood, I see a lot of rooftop antennas for TV. Those antennas, will they work for, they look like bow and arrows, back to the net?
Joe, you could use quite a bit more audio. Your audio is quite low, but yes, I heard you very well. The television aerials that are on the roofs that you're seeing right now, would they work for ham radio? Sort of. There are guys who report signals into them on 2 meters and 432 quite successfully. On 10 meters, it's not going to work very well, and down to the HF frequencies fairly poorly. But for 2 meters and 432 and 220, a television aerial gives you medium characteristics. It's worth a try, as long as you're not putting a kilowatt into it, and nothing's going to explode, so to speak. Go ahead and give it a try. Nothing bad can happen, and I would go and do it. Now, I'm kind of amazed that there are still television aerials on the roof in your community. Pretty soon I can look you up and find out where you live. I know that in Brooklyn, where Mel lives, there are very few operating television aerials. His house is one of the very few in all of Manhattan Beach that has one. In Huntington, Long Island, if I look real, real hard, I may find a couple of houses out of the quarter of a million people who live in Huntington Township. I'll find very few houses that have an operating television aerial on the roof. My house is one of them. So I'm kind of curious as to what community you live in, Joe, that still has them. And speak up to the mic because your audio is a little bit lower than it could be. KCQQIW, KQIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, sorry about that. I think my mic is up over here. Yeah, all over like Harrison and Harrison, New York, Westchester County, a lot of those private houses have big, big rooftop antennas for TV use, and I guess they never took them down. I mean, really nice ones, too.
And yes, it would be worth a try. The price is right, and if you put a rotator on it, you'd really have a lot of fun. It's not going to have a clean pattern, but a hell of a lot of antennas don't have a clean pattern. It's still going to have peaks and valleys and gain in some directions and not gain in other directions. So even though the television aerials were designed for reception, I think there are very few television aerials that would have any trouble handling, let's say, 50 watts. You don't want to put a kilowatt into them, but I think 50 watts, I'll bet you almost all of them can take it. And if at worst they can't take it, and the driven element gets a little bit damaged, the repair would be very easy once you discovered it. Modern-day television aerials are all fed with RG59 or RG6 coaxial cables, and so they can take it very nicely. Not very many people are using 300-ohm twin lead anymore, but even if they did, matching it to 300-ohm twin lead for a smart guy is not very difficult. The easiest way to match into 300-ohm twin lead is with a half-wave coax balance. In other words, you literally take a half-wave of cable, and the impedance of the cable doesn't matter, because half-wavelength cable repeats impedance. Take a half-wavelength cable, bend it back into a U-shape, and connect it to the transmission line. All three shields come together. The transmission line connects semiconductor to semiconductor on one half of the U-shaped half-wavelength line. Now, the two semiconductors of the U-shaped half-wavelength line connect to the 300-ohm twin lead. You study that and you realize it is a voltage doubler and it's an impedance quadrupler. Your 50-ohm cable becomes 200 ohms of balanced output, close enough to 300 ohms. That's a 1.5 standing wave ratio. Don't worry about it. I've used that very often to feed 300-ohm twin lead from coax. Works like a charm. In fact, a number of the Yagis that I've worked on use that method of feeding the driven element. The output of the half-wave coax feeds the T-match. And the T-match was made for 200 ohms. Even if it was 300 ohms twin lead, to a T-match, it would work like a charm. And there's ways of readjusting that. You'd be amazed how much you can do to adjust the resistive component of the driven element of an antenna by doing nothing but adjusting the length. That seems to be a very well-kept secret. And if you go to Tom Williams' website, you can read an article on a couple thousand words I've written on that exact subject. Tom Williams is WA1MBA. Whiskey Alpha 1 Mike Bravo Alpha. Go to WA1MBA.org, I think it is. And at the bottom of his page on microwave ham radio, you'll see an article by KQLIW about how to get any impedance match you want to your dipole or to the driven element of any Yagi. Just by adjusting length, it's amazingly easy to do. And as I said, I haven't seen any suggestions about that in any of the respective ham radio manuals. That article of mine was published in the United Kingdom, was published in New Zealand, was published in Australia, and I've got a lot of positive feedback from it. I've attempted to publish the article in the United States, and each of the potential publishers says, I'm not interested, it's a boring subject. Everybody knows that. Well, everybody doesn't know that. It was also published in the proceedings of the New England DHF conference that took place a year or so ago. But it hasn't really been published in an American magazine. So, impedance matching is nowhere near as difficult as the average guy thinks. So, I would go and do it if I were you, Joe. And by the way, when you do it, please come back and tell us how well it works. Are you thinking of buying one of those houses with one of those aerials and giving it a try? Or is it owned by one of your relatives and you're thinking of using the aerial that they're not using right now? KC2QIW, KQIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, Roger. Answer to your question is I believe that a lot of those neighbors of mine, they don't want them up there. So if I say, hey, listen, he wants to take it down for you, they'll probably say yes.
Yeah, that's the good news. One of the things you're going to discover, though, is that most television aerials are made for biggest bang for the dollar. They're not made to last 40 years. They're made to hang in there for 5 years, so to speak, and most of those aerials are probably 15 years old. So you will find some of them where because of the ice storm that happened a few years ago. There's some missing elements, bent elements, rusted components. So although you're getting it for free, you're going to be getting a not very robustly constructed antenna. It's been out in the weather for quite a number of years, so it's going to be a little bit on the rough side. For a guy who's very crafty, to beef up the things that are broken, to shine up the aluminum that's become corroded, and so on, there's ways that you can refurbish those antennas, you can get full performance out of them. But I think you're going to discover that the aerials on people's roofs, in some cases, are a little bit rust in performance, in mechanical engineering, so to speak, when you look at it 10 years downrange. Back to you for that comment, Joe.
Okay, Weiler, comment.
Mel recognized. Go ahead, Mel, first.
Okay, there was a number of articles that were written in a number of the magazines, CQ, Ham Radio, and all, about using TV antennas, modifying them, using the elements to build 6-meter, 2-meter, and 70-centimeter antennas. In other words, the aluminum elements are very lightweight. They're fairly good. They can stand a lot of wind. Many of you, you'll find the the elements may some to be bent a little bit, but you can salvage enough of them off there, and they're very easy cleaned up once you take the elements off. If they're corroded and all, the aluminum will polish up real quick with a piece of sandpaper. So I built a number of the homebrew antennas that I used on that field day. Basically for portable use that, you know, easily come apart. I built a 2-meter one really out of scrap pieces of everything. And a couple of the elements, number of the elements on it were salvaged from TV antennas. So if you look back, you'll find a number of articles showing you methods of converting them, using that as a material. Like I say, the elements themselves basically do make a great source of
Yep, lots of good raw materials are available. And for a guy who's crafty enough to make modifications, you can do some real good work. Joe, I've got a question for you. Did I write down your call letters correctly? Kilo Charlie 2, Quebec, India, Whiskey. Did I get that right, Joe? Go ahead.
No, the India is a, KC2, Quebec, Yankee, Whiskey. It's KC2, Quebec, Yankee, Whiskey.
That makes an awful lot more sense. I heard QIW, Quebec, India, Whiskey, instead of Quebec, Yankee, Whiskey, and that's an entirely different person, so that creates some confusion. Okay, we got you pinned down. Yeah, there's some good raw materials up there for a crafty guy. Some of it's a little bit beat up. I remember collecting old television aerials that were abandoned on people's rooms in Brooklyn when I was living there while going to college. And that became raw material by which I built quite a few other antennas, just like Mel is discussing. Though some of it was very thin-walled tubing, not super strong, but adequate as long as you don't have an ice storm. So depending on what you do with one of those aerials, whether it works or doesn't work, please come back and tell us about it. Back to you, Joe.
Nick, I got a comment, W3WK.
Okay, Eugene, we're going to come back to you in a second. Joe first, go ahead.
Yeah, I was thinking about it, but, they look clean. They really look nice, clean. They're not damaged. There's a whole bunch of them over there in downtown Harrison. A lot of older private houses, I guess. And I guess, a lot of them are retired. Okay, I'll pass it over to the other station. This is KC2, Quebec, Yankee, Whiskey. I want to mention another thing. I just recently ordered the waterproof log book, and I like it. It's really, really nice.
You said waterproof blank. It sounds like waterproof log book. Want to run that by again, Joe?
Yeah, I think my mic is, I gotta get a new mic for this radio. It's a waterproof lock book, and the pages are very strong. They don't rip out. Very adorable. They come in different sizes and whatnot. It's really nice. It's a really nice book to get.
Who makes that thing, and what does it cost, Joe?
Yeah, I'm going to have to look it up in the book. Harry, give me a second.
You can go on their website, www.logbooks.com, and
okay, I think you were talking to us with a handy-talky, but www.logbooks.com. Alrighty, that's good to know. Eugene, you with your comment? Go right ahead, Eugene.
They come in big size.
Okay, you got me now, Dick?
Yes, I do, Eugene. Go ahead.
Okay, W3WK4ID. I made an antenna for 2 meters and 440. I bought it from a store. It's one of those satellite antennas, you know, and one is horizontal, one's vertical on the same boom. So you use an AB switch. You can have it horizontal or vertical. Now, you take that vertical and horizontal, and you put a T there, a T, one line coming down to your transmitter. Now, when you go to transmit, would that be very high SWR? Because you're using two antennas at one time, one for horizontal, one for vertical? Big question mark, Dick. Back to you.
Very fine, Eugene. If you put that D connector at the antenna, and your horizontal antenna will assume is 50 ohm, and your vertical antenna is 50 ohm, your D connector is putting the two in parallel, you end up with 25 ohms. 25 ohms on the common port of the D connector to a 50 ohm cable represents a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio, which is not perfect, but it ain't so bad. 2-to-1 SWR equates to about half decibel of loss, 1/12 of an S unit. That's not a whole lot. That's not bad. Add to your feed line, if your feed line has any reasonable length to it, which has a little bit of insertion loss, depending on the loss of your cable, the 2-to-1 SWR gets better. If your cable has a couple of dB of loss, by the time it gets to the shack, your reflected energy is being dissipated a little bit, and therefore in the shack you'll only see a 1.5 standing wave ratio, for instance. So even without correction, that's not bad. And 2 meter 440, you're feeding them both in parallel. Oh, wait a minute now. The answer I just gave you would be for a horizontal and vertical antenna, both on the same band. One of yours is 440, one of them is 220. Life gets a little bit more complicated because your 440 antenna, when fed 2 meters, has an impedance that might be very low, and therefore feeding that simultaneously with the 2 meters on a T-connector might not be a good thing. It's going to take a little bit further study, where it's a dual-band antenna, and you feed the two of them with a T-connector, I do not recommend that. I didn't say it can't be done. I'm saying I do not recommend it. If you used a diplexing filter at that location, then it would work like a charm. One feed line goes to a diplexing filter. The output of the filter on 440 connects to the 440 antenna. The output of the filter on 2 meters goes to the 2 meter antenna. So with the right kind of a filter out there, one piece of feed line would do it very nicely. You have to worry a little bit about weatherproofing that filter. Good thing I recognize the fact that you've got a dual band antenna. Back to you, Eugene, KQRIW.
Beck, you didn't hear me correctly. I said the antenna is 2 meters horizontal and 2 meters vertical. One's up and one's horizontal. Now, I'm saying that put a T on there. Go ahead, Dick. Go ahead, Dick. It's only for 2 meters only. 2 meters vertical and 2 meters horizontal, I meant to say.
Yeah, the first time you did say 2 meter 440. All right, if they're both on 2 meters, horizontal and vertical, without a doubt you can feed them with a T-connector. And there's ways you can correct the T-connector and make it perfect as far as the feed line is concerned. But if you did no correction at the antenna, at the T-connector, 2-to-1 VSWR, and maybe a 1.5 VSWR in the shack, that ain't bad. When you do that, when you're feeding the horizontal and vertical simultaneously, you are now creating slant 45 degree polarization. Your polarization is halfway between horizontal and vertical, which is not bad. The antenna you're listening to from me right now is that kind of an antenna. I didn't do it by having horizontal and vertical in a T connector. I did it by rotating the boom of the Yagi at a 45 degree angle. My whole Yagi is tilted 45 degrees in polarization compared to the horizontal ground that's nearby. That way my antenna that you're listening to is halfway between horizontal and vertical, and I can talk to both group of people. I talk to the horizontal people on sideband, and I talk to the 2 meter repeater people with vertical, because I'm halfway between the two. So that's a good approach. And if you had a box up there with relays in it, and a way of controlling those relays, you could decide to select the pure horizontal, the pure vertical, or the T-connector and feed both. That would be a fun project, to put a box full of relays up at the antenna with ways of commanding those relays. The simple approach would be a bunch of wires that feed power to the relays. But if you're real smart, there's ways you can send positive and negative signals and whatever, AC signals, down the coax cable to control the relays. Back to you, Eugene. K2LIW. Antennas are fun.
Okay, thank you very much, Dick. Thank you. WCWK clear.
Okay, now we've had, I know Bob, PNJ, and both Rich, I think in that order. Bob, PNJ, I know you had some further questions to comment on. If you're still with us, Bob, go right ahead. Okay, and maybe Bob had to leave. Rich, I know you wanted to discuss something else. You got it, Rich.
Yeah, Dick, good evening. It's Julio. That big amplifier I built, if I want to run that at half power, I don't know if I heard or somebody told me or I read, the proper way to load it up is to load it up at full power, which is about 3 dB above legal limit, and then back off the drive. Or can I lower the drive to say 50 watts, 40-50 watts, load it up to maximum power at that power level, which means the loading control will be more over counterclockwise towards, and then just run it on the sideband at the 1500 watt level. The reason I'm bringing this subject, I've been vacillating back and forth whether we go with a tracked tri-band Yagi or a quad with the new roof tower. And I'm thinking in terms of a tri-band like a Mosley TA-33, because it has about no maintenance as compared to a quad, which is fiberglass wire. And I would have to back the power down so I don't pop the traps on those bands. So what's the best way of running that amp at half power, the legal limit, without flat topping and bothering people on the band? Back to that, in 2 E.
Now, you've got about three or four choices here, Rich. You've got more capability than you know about. The method that's going to give you the highest instantaneous linearity, the highest third-order intercept point, the lowest possible third-order intermodulation distortion, is to simply drop back on power, on drive. So line it up for whatever method you do to give you maximum power output. Lower your drive power so your output is 3 dB lower. You're not now using the peak envelope power capability of the amplifier, using something 3 dB lower than that. Most amplifiers, when you back off on the drive power, the linearity goes extremely high. That's good. The efficiency won't be great when you do that. You'll have a little bit lower efficiency. But efficiency is not the main thing you care about, because you're not running off batteries. You're running off Con Ed, and they got lots of power. So that's the highest linearity technique. Now, the other techniques, in order to give you the same efficiency, would be to lower the drive power, readjust tuning and loading control. Let me show you why that happens. When I lower the drive power, it's kind of obvious that the plate voltage swing with your modulation is going to be a lower number. If you now lighten the loading and readjust the tuning, you'll come back to the point where you're now getting the full voltage swing of the plate. And you'll come back to the same efficiency or a tiny bit higher. But now your linearity won't be quite as great because you're going through the full voltage swing of the plate circuit. As the tube goes through its full voltage swing, in one direction it does a little bit of flat topping, in the other direction it does a little bit of crossover distortion, bottoming you could call it. And so by reloading you'll get higher efficiency, but you'll not be as linear. The highest linearity is heavy loading for the full power output and just back off on the drive. A third example would be, now you've got transformers you've added in order to boost the B+. You could start using those transformers in reverse. Lower the B+ to the plate circuit of the amplifier. That lowers its power output capability. And might make the tubes last a little bit longer. That one I'm not sure about. So lowering the B+ will lower your power output. Simply lowering the drive will give you the highest linearity. And lowering the drive and readjust tuning and loading will give you the highest efficiency of the plate circuit, but a little bit less linearity. Those are the three approaches at first, and I guarantee there's a fourth and a fifth as we dig into it. You're running a triode, so you don't have the option of lowering the screen voltage. If it was a tetrode tube, and you could lower the screen voltage, you have another way of lowering the power output capability. N2EO, K2RIW on the TechNet.
PKEY with a comment.
Yeah, go ahead, Mel. I bet you've been here.
Of course, this is K2KEY, and of course, having experience with that, basically, that amplifier built by the famous Collins Radio Company. I'll tell you a few things about the final, the design, and, you know, and Collins, the book, the detailed book on that amplifier is quite involved. An awful lot of information, a lot of technical information, a lot of formulation and everything on there, thinking. Now, you got to remember one thing. In the Collins unit, they use a rotary inductor, which I don't think Rich has. I'm sure Rich has just a tap inductor. Am I correct, Rich? Over.
That's correct, Bill.
Okay. Now, as Collins explained it, that the creep